Hey, I'm Zale, host of Preconceived, a podcast that challenges the preconceptions that shape how we view the world. Preconceived examines both our approach to major life choices, but also our perspectives on issues to which we may have been overly conditioned towards certain opinions. Each episode features a different topic, with experts, researchers, and luminaries in their respective fields. We think you will especially enjoy recent episodes on polyamory, regretting parenthood, dopamine nation, and myths of the beauty industry. Find Preconceived wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, my sweet loves. This week's guests, plural, are Emily and Nate Morris, and they are partners and co-authors of Transforming Orgasms with Psychedelics, Cannabis, and Science. And I have a feeling this is a book that many of our listeners are going to want to pick up and hear more about. I know, as you can imagine, Jeremy handled a lot of the questions in this one while I sat eyes wide, just taking it all in. Our conversation centered around the sex, drugs, and rhythm theory of human evolution, which is a sex-based hypothesis for co-evolution between humans and psychoactive plants and fungi. Fungi. You're going to love this. We did. And we're so grateful to have you join us again for another episode. Take care out there.
All right. Well, I can't wait for this conversation because we're talking about like all of my favorite things packaged into one thing. We're talking about orgasms. I love orgasms. Mm-hmm. We're talking about psychedelics. I do love
Jeremy. Do you like psychedelics?
I sure do.
Oh, you do.
And we're talking about science.
And cannabis. Science. Cannabis is in there.
Right. Cannabis is in there, which not technically a psychedelic, you know, it's in there. It's a psychoactive, I guess you could say. So I love all those things. But why are we talking about all these things together, Bridie?
Well, today in our studio, our Zoom studio, we are welcoming our guests, Emily and Nathaniel Morris, who have a book called Transforming Orgasms with Psychedelics, Cannabis, and Science.
Hell yeah. Love the book title. I'm very curious.
So curious
about the book. Where does this book come from? Why did you guys decide to write it? But before we get into all that, please introduce yourselves.
Well, thanks so much for having us, guys. It's a pleasure to be here. My name's Nate Morris. Full name's Nathaniel Morris, but everybody calls me Nate, and I'm here with my wife.
Yeah, and I am Emily Morris. Sometimes Emily Halverson, depending on where you're looking. But
Now you guys are married.
We are married. Yeah, going on 9 years.
9 years married. Okay. Give me the backstory here. What do you guys, before writing a book called Transforming Orgasms with Psychedelic Cannabis and Science, what was your day job before you became authors?
Great question. So we're both in the cannabis industry. We're both cannabis subject matter experts. And we have been our whole lives. We met through the cannabis space. So I guess the way this all got started, about 10, 11 years ago, I was on a television show growing CBD cannabis on the Discovery Channel. And Emily was Miss High Times 2012. And we both got paired together to lobby Congress on behalf of pediatric patients who needed CBD to treat their seizures. And we met and fell in love and saw that Canada was getting ready to legalize and decided we would elope to Canada. That's kind of the fun romantic story of how this whole ball got rolling.
Fun. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we came over here and I still currently work for a licensed producer here in Canada. So that is my day job. So on weekends and evenings, we've been working on the book. But yeah, it's basically even explaining it to everyone. It's all cannabis all the time in our household. Like even we're now psychedelics and cannabis. But yeah, it's been a fun journey.
Yeah. So it started with studying cannabinoids and particularly the rare cannabinoids like CBD and THCV. But there's peyote is also legal in Canada. So we started studying that too. And there's a bunch of chemicals in peyote that haven't been researched much. So that's kind of how we got started with it.
Fun. Okay. I definitely, I'll let you go ahead there, Brady, but I definitely have some cannabinoid questions.
Me too.
Oh, amazing. Sweet.
Me too. And I did have a question that I wanted to ask before we dive into that. What was it? Tell me if I'm wrong, but some of the questions that I'm sure Jeremy and I both have about cannabinoids, I have assumed that there just isn't the research yet because we've only been allowed to study it and experiment with it in like laboratories and or whatever for only a short amount of time. Is that correct? Or is there more information out there available than I could have possibly imagined?
There's a lot more than people realize. You're not wrong that the research has been hugely curtailed and there ought to be way more. I mean, people discovered this was an enormous medical discovery 50, 60 years ago, even before that. So we should be far further along than we are. But that said, you always hear this refrain where we just don't have the data because we haven't been allowed to study it. And I remember being frustrated hearing that 20 years ago. And now there's literally like thousands of peer-reviewed journal articles on the subject. So it's tough to stay on top of all of the latest research. There's so much of it. But it's a little bit of both, I guess.
And would we find that data and those peer-reviewed like papers and things like that on the same channels that we would look for other like medical
Google Scholar is your best friend.
Okay.
It's incredible. Just about every good study is now publicly available and fairly easily accessible. Just Google like minor cannabinoids on Google Scholar, you'll get hundreds of studies and they're wonderful.
Okay.
So there, correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I'm so wrong on this, but I feel like I heard somewhere there's like thousands of cannabinoids.
There's just over the number kind of varies between usually we say like over 100 or over 120.
Okay.
Because they're very similar, depending on how you're defining them, the number can change. But it's around that 100. There's over 400 active components in cannabis alone, but that cannabinoid number is around 100, 120.
Okay. So what I'm really when it comes to psychedelics, I consider myself a pretty like well-versed psychonaut, someone who's like dabbled in psychedelics for probably the last decade and have like put pretty good use to it. Not utilizing psychedelics just to like get fucked up, but like highly intention-based psychedelic work. I think psychedelics can be amazing. I think they can be extraordinarily healing. They can also be a hell of a lot of fun. Cannabis, I've had a weird relationship to cannabis my whole life. I can't smoke technically because I have a lung disease. So you know, I did smoke weed in high school. Bad, you know, it was not good for my lungs. And then had some like bad experience with edibles when I was in like university. Bridie poisoned me basically with like 14 grams in like a small batch of brownies, and I, you know, didn't remember who I was. And so like just like cannabis, I always was like, I don't know, I don't think it's for me. But I just recently, and I talked about this on a recent podcast, but I just recently started kind of dabbling in cannabis again. Now that here in Canada, you know, cannabis is pretty easily accessible. We can go down to the Nova Scotia Liquor, you know, Liquor Corporation store and buy it right there. And it's pretty well dosed out. And in the past, I was always like, edibles are edibles, you know, like I'll take one edible and they say it's indica. I don't know. Take the other one, says it's sativa. It's all the fucking same to me. But as I started to kind of take some gummies here and there, just like experimenting with this one or that one, I started to really be able to see, oh, wow, these are very different sensations that I'm having when I have, you know, these ones that I got from, you know, in this package versus these ones. And I've found a gummy that I am totally in love with. It's the first time I've ever utilized cannabis where A, I can have sex while I'm on it and enjoy, and B, I can also be social and be out without feeling like I want to crawl into a cave and never be seen by another human again. And what I've come to realize is that it's a blend of THC and CBG. So I'm super curious. I don't know anything about CBG. I don't know anything about like CBN. You know, I've got like a little bit of an idea of like CBD. Okay, sure. But like CBN, CBG, those are two cannabinoids that I have dabbled with that are in tandem with THC. And it's really wild to me the vast difference of feeling to the experience that you have when I've tried the THC with CBG or the THC with CBN. So what is CBG, and like, why does it make me feel, it makes me feel like I had like six espressos and I could like, I want to go for a run and I wanted to like lift weights. Like it's crazy. I've never felt this way before, utilizing THC. And also the sex part, that's a big part for me because weed just made me so turned off from sex, but the THC and CBG, it feels great. It's really fun.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And we could kind of answer both portions. Sometimes the second answer is a little, not the answer, but so CBG is an interesting cannabinoid. It's actually CBGA, all cannabinoids start off as what are called acids. Like they're not actually, they have to become activated to interact with us. So when we think of like THC, it's precursor, and like what we look at in the plant is actually THCA. And you have CBDA. And what those all come from are actually CBGA. It's the precursor to all of those cannabinoids in what they call the deriveric pathway, the oliveric pathway. And it's just another cannabinoid. Why it's doing stuff is kind of a difficult answer. So part of like in the book why we wanted to write it is we always get this question like, what should I consume? Why is it doing this? What's going on? And like we said, there are some studies starting to come out and looking at like what is affecting majority of the population. But what's actually going on is we have an internal system, our ECS or endocannabinoid system, that is what's linking in with the cannabinoids and other stuff in cannabis, specifically cannabinoids. That's where it gets a little complicated is that we're all different, right? Part of what the book is doing in that journaling system component of it is noting those things. So like cannabis typically with THC, I'm not into it. For some reason we added this CBG and here's what I've noted, right? So it's about that. And I think people like when they come to cannabis, they're like, they want that specific question where it's, you kind of have to, you know, figure it out a little. And, you know, we recommend low and slow. That's always been a thing around the industry of just trying and kind of noticing. Another thing is also like you know, where you are, like your mindset and your setting, which we also go into in the book, because that's a big role in psychedelics, but it also happens with cannabis. And people are like, like, so for example, you mentioned Indica sativa, which is a really, it's been called a pet peeve of mine.
Sure,
In that, you know, the language around it, and we've kind of expressed this full taxonomy of indicas make you sleepy and sativas make you energetic, when really what's happening is those cannabinoids and terpenes and other things, you know, working together. Again, a lot of science needs to be looked at that, but we know for sure those cannabinoids are what's kind of going on. And just noting that and looking into it, not to like compare it to alcohol, because they're drastically different, but you wouldn't walk into like a bar and automatically need to know your perfect drink, right? Like you work at that over time and you realize what you like and what you don't like. And if for some reason people just don't like to apply that to cannabis, but that's the same thing. Like you've lived, you've learned, and you've noticed this thing about you personally that has been effective. Like if you look into it, maybe a big majority of the population has also experienced those things, but it's about you know kind of that journey and noticing those things. And it's amazing that we're in Canada. You also brought up like testing and, you know, having edibles that were homemade, and we are so lucky here in Canada, as someone who's come from the legal and legacy market in the States, to have not only regulated products but regulated testing. So a big misconception, like when you see products in the States, it's like, wow, there's drinks with like 3,000 milligrams. It's like, okay, maybe. We don't know how those were tested. And also, like up here in Canada, we have this regulatory regime that is its standard, and you have to like go back and test and test for certain things. So we actually really know what we're getting up here in terms of cannabinoid content. Hopefully in time, we'll get some more, you know, regulations around like terpenes and other awesome compounds. But that's just something that you have the luxury of walking into, you know, the Nova Scotia store and actually knowing what's in that product. So,
And for, you know, for anybody who's listening to this, that maybe, hasn't really dabbled in THC for whatever reason that might be. That's one of the things that I think really helped me in sort of developing this appreciation for THC was the regulation that comes with, you know, the situation that we have up here in Canada. And, you know, going into the NSLC and speaking to the employees there, like they're, it's really funny because like the weed section is like separate from the alcohol section. And so you have to go through the liquor store to get into the weed section here in Nova Scotia. I know it's different, like province to province. Mm-hmm. And like the employees in the alcohol section versus the employees in the weed section, like they're very different. And then like, so, you know, you're talking to these people who are so well-versed in cannabis. But there's also this sort of vibe of like, are you guys on it right now too? Like you guys are so, they're like max chill, you know, it's so
fun. A laid back industry.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Well, that's amazing. I love that. I kind of want to veer more towards the book now, because I feel like I steered that conversation a little bit.
Right.
Too
no, don't get us on cannabinoids.
I know. Fuck.
But what you describe is interesting. One of the things that we encounter is that with Western medicine, we tend to want a one size fits all approach. And there's this, when we talk about the subject of cannabis and psychedelics in the context of sex, people want to know like, well, what is the right mixture of THC and CBD? And what we notice is, as a culture, especially in recent years, we've wrapped our minds around the idea that everybody's different sexually, and that you would never have an expectation that there would be one thing that turns everybody on. And what we're trying to communicate in the book is that we really need to approach cannabis with that same lens, that the two people are different in such profound ways that when they consume the same product, it would be obscene to expect them to have the same results from it. And that part of figuring out like what works for you in a sexual context is trial and error, and pursuing the things that interest you and avoiding the things that don't. And the same is true with safe use of, you know, psychoactive substances. It's about listening to yourself and figuring out what's working for you and what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to veer to the book as well, but Jeremy sort of shared his origin story when it comes to cannabis. And mine was a little bit different, and I've been looking, like I mentioned in the beginning when I was talking about research, like I've been sort of looking to see if there's research to back up some of the questions that I have about how my long-term use of cannabis is affecting me, particularly sexually, like hormonally. Like, is there a possibility that it's like my daily use of cannabis over the last two decades has, you know, if I stop, or like, when I introduced it to my life, it was in a, I believe, you know, it was a recreational sort of thing for myself and for my peers at the time. But it was also, it came on the heels of some like pretty major trauma, like right after. I never smoked weed until after my sister passed away. And then it was like, it felt like in that moment, self-medicating. And now when I talk to people in mental health and addictions circles, and we talk about trauma and like how that can like affect your addictive sort of tendencies. Like, so I'm starting to kind of look at my relationship with cannabis from that lens, and not wanting to like pathologize myself and see how it's being affected. But it's almost like when I walk into a cannabis store, I want to ask the same questions that Jeremy just asked. It's like, what's the best suited like anti-anxiety med for me? You know, that's kind of the answer that I'm looking for. And after 20 years, I feel like I should have found it by now. But anyway, I just wanted to introduce my complicated relationship with cannabis into this conversation, so you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah. So I am. Okay. To the book. That was a very like long. So that was the epilogue. And now
right.
we're
the prologue.
The prologue. Yeah. Now we're getting into the meat of something that I think is so fucking crazy fascinating. So, Transforming Orgasms with Psychedelics, Cannabis, and Science is the book that you guys have put together, and the science part is where I kind of want to like step in first and kind of tap into. So if anybody out there is not familiar with the stoned ape theory, I would love if you guys could step in and give us a bit of context as to what that is. I think the stoned ape theory, it's one of my favorite theories about coevolution. I think it's like so cool to think about. You know, of course, not everybody kind of vibes with it, and some people think it's kind of silly, but I for one am a believer. I want to believe the stone ape theory just as much as I want to believe that aliens exist. So please give us a bit of background as to what the stoned ape theory is, and then maybe from there kind of guide us to the sex, drugs, and rhythm theory and how those two things are kind of like
absolutely
commingling with one another.
Sure. So, okay. So first, the stoned ape theory. So the theory is 30 years old. And when it was first introduced, it was introduced in a book called Food of the Gods by Terence McKenna. And the idea is that early humans around the time of speciation, so like 300,000 years ago, discovered psychedelic mushrooms. And the theory goes that the act of consuming psychedelic mushrooms and incorporating them into the diet led to a dramatic increase in brain size and the invention of language and higher levels of consciousness. Now, the challenge with this theory is that, A, there's just not very much archaeological evidence from that time. What we do have is a big mystery. In human evolution, the human brain grew like more than doubled in size in a very short period of time, much faster than we've ever seen any other animal in the fossil record do that. And so there's a big question mark on what caused that. And the stoned ape theory basically was built around that fact point and trying to reverse engineer from there an explanation that perhaps mushrooms were responsible for that increase in brain size. So the pop culture loves this theory. And
Yeah.
I think a lot of people who are into psychedelics, like I share your desire for this to be true. And I think a lot of people, it kind of feels true in your bones. Like if you've had a lot of psychedelic experiences, there's something so primal and like, yeah, it's, it just, it feels right. And our theory, what we call the sex, drugs, and rhythm theory, we describe it as being adjacent to the stoned ape theory. So it neither confirms the theory, nor does it argue against the theory. It's a different version. So the key difference with the theory that we're putting forward is that we're not attributing the expanse in brain size to psychedelic mushrooms. That's not where we go with it. What our theory is that when early humans encountered these psychedelic mushrooms, they inevitably tried having sex on them and discovered it made sex better. And the original stoned ape theory also acknowledged that point and suggested that, you know, one of the things that attracted early humans to these mushrooms was the sexual enhancing properties. But what we say is, if you just stop there, if you don't credit the mushrooms with expanding our brain size, if we just say we would have incorporated these mushrooms into our natural mating rituals, that alone is a major step forward in our scientific understanding of how coevolution worked, because that is a good enough reason to have started consuming them regularly and making them a natural part of our diet. And the fact that we can look at how psychedelics and other psychoactive substances affect us sexually, we can draw inferences that would have applied to 300,000 years ago. Like, if we know that it makes sex better and people who have access to these substances have sex more often, we can infer that that means that they would have had more children back then, which means that natural selection would have positively selected for people that enjoyed getting intoxicated and having sex. And from there, we create this theory of human evolution, where we look at where, as humans spread around the world, what substances they would have encountered. And, you know, they encountered mushrooms 300,000 years ago, around the time of speciation. But as soon as we left Africa, Eurasia was covered with cannabis. And so it logically makes sense that humans would have been bumping into cannabis. And if we just spent the past 250,000 years incorporating psychedelic mushrooms into our natural mating rituals, surely when we encountered cannabis, we would have done the same. And just understanding that over the course of human evolution, for the vast majority of that time, we were almost certainly mixing psychedelic mushrooms, cannabis, into our natural mating rituals. Suddenly we look at a fact pattern like what you just described, where like 20 years ago you started using cannabis and it's been of some benefit to you in a sexual context. And knowing that that's probably the experience of most of humanity makes it seem a little less scandalous and a little bit less like something you need to concern yourself with the possible health implications, and more like it's probably a natural part of your diet that's healthy, it sounds to me like. And many people would probably benefit from following your example. Does that make sense?
It takes the taboo away from it. It takes the stigma away from it, normalizes it in a sense. I love this. I think this is really fun. You know, like I've just recently I've been like nerding out about, have you guys heard of the bicameral mind hypothesis? Yeah. Like that stuff, it's so fascinating to me. Like, it's just such an interesting way to kind of look at, us as a species, look at our past, kind of think about the ways that we found ourselves, where we are now, and to put into context some of the things that we've been through, like in recent history that, you know, as we start to kind of shift and evolve societally today, you know, one of the things that I'm thinking about is like, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, if you were to tell me that, that it would be commonplace for, psychologists and physicians to be taking seriously the benefits of psilocybin, in my 30s, I would go, that sounds a bit like bunk. I doubt it. Highly doubt that. Or, you know, the use of MDMA in psychotherapy to help people with PTSD. It's like, well, I could see how that would work, but I could not imagine a world where that would be possible. And yet we find ourselves here. And so, you know, we find ourselves here after a long history, at least long history to us, you know, people who are alive today, a long history of our society demonizing and criminalizing these substances that are now having a resurgence, you know, since the time of McKenna, you know, writing about the stoned ape theory and things like that. Like, we're seeing this resurgence come up. And so it's very interesting to me to like kind of look at the history of drugs, the history of psychedelics, and to kind of view how the fuck did we get from there to here, and why on earth did we spend, you know, the last whatever it was, 50 years, locking people away for using substances that now today we're seeing can hold really valuable benefits. And one of the things that I know that you guys have kind of touched on is this concept that like prohibition has been somewhat tied to policing sexuality. And I think that's really interesting. I'd love to hear, like, because I've never thought about it that way. I'd love to hear your thoughts on like where is this a theory that you guys kind of put together yourselves, or like is this kind of in the zeitgeist of like, well, yeah, the reason we've been, you know, doing prohibition with these certain substances is because we don't want everybody out there just having a fucking orgy until and society will eventually collapse. You
know? No, right. One will go to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yes and no. So it is there in the history. It's not often talked about as much. I think it's starting to come to the forefront. We often talk about, so prohibition essentially started right like 100 years ago and around the 1920s. Canada was actually prior to going illegal in the 1920s with the states going in 1937. When you look at that, like a lot of people know the history of, you know, Henry J. Anslinger, who was a very top ranking political official in the states, that was really pushing this propaganda along. And you see it in reference to racial, you know, tying the term marijuana, right? We really try to avoid that word in the industry today, not because people using it per se today are using it from that place or from a place of bad, place of good.
I derogatory.
But, yeah. You know, it's tying that. But when we start to look and even like take back that curtain, what it's referencing to is women, you know, going to jazz musicians and having these sexual feelings while on these substances. And so it's saying it in this, you know, negative, super negative racial sense, but it's tying back to women. Hey, we have to control, you know, the sexuality aspect of this. And, you know, what better way to get more people on board than to say, hey, you know, your wives and your sisters and, you know, are all going to be under this spell of marijuana. So it's kind of that subcontext that we have a lot throughout our, you know, history. But, you know, it's, and we kind of touched on this also in the book around, you know, organized religions coming about too, and taking away kind of that shamanistic, you know, we used to have a lot of sex rituals and coming of age rituals around, you know, psychoactive substances, and they were normalized in those societies. We've kind of taken it as this bad thing and stigmatized it, thus making it what people didn't want it to be in the first place, you know, or saying that it was. But if we just had kind of that conversation, you know, that's really where we're coming from with that.
If you look at the like the arc of virtually all the controlled substances, like LSD, mescaline, MDMA, they all started as like celebrated medical discoveries, and it didn't become something that it was viewed as a moral hazard until hippies, usually in combination with cannabis, started incorporating it into a like free sex lifestyle. I mean, you look at MDMA, that birthed the rave scene, but that was started as a pharmaceutical product for couples therapy. The mescaline and LSD, you know, earlier generations, but same thing. It was a celebrated medical discovery until you started to see people associating it with free love. And then it became this moral hazard that we needed to regulate. Sometimes it's overt, like with cannabis, the historical claims around cannabis causing white women to have sex with minorities, it's very overt. With psychedelics, it was a little more subtextual, but still very much the case. And as in general, the way our society handles drug policy is like that. It's a substance can be celebrated for its medical applications, but as soon as we see people having sex with it, suddenly we put that in a category and call it recreational. And it's pretty hard to define recreational other than that, other than this category of stuff that we kind of vaguely associate with sexual activity.
Turn Me On Podcast, we'll be back after this short break.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Huh. Yeah, totally. Yeah. How do you guys feel about, it must excite you, you know, to see articles coming out like, organizations like Theracell here in Canada, providing patients with access psychotherapy assisted psychedelics for people who are experiencing, you know, like end of life anxieties, things like that. Like we're definitely seeing a turning point. Things with like Michael Pollan's book coming out, that was huge. Like that was a huge win for the psychedelic world. Do you guys feel like we're on the right track? You know, do you feel like we're going in the right direction at the correct speed, or you know, as people who are like in the industry, like how do you feel about the way that society is approaching psychedelics and psychoactive substances in general?
Yeah, I think it's
good. Yeah, you can never get there fast enough for our case, but it's way faster than I would have ever imagined a few years ago.
Yeah. I would say living through it in the cannabis space, Nate has, you know, about 10 years on me, but I joined, you know, I've been in the industry for about 13 years. So right on the cusp of, you know, what we kind of refer to as the legacy market coming into, you know, legal streams. And it's very similar. You know, you're seeing very similar conversations. And I think almost it does seem a little more sped up. Maybe that's just me, you know, getting into my 30s, but it definitely seems like, hey, we went through this with cannabis. We kind of have, you know, some muscle memory. And if anything, I think it's also opening the door for just drug policy reform and, you know, topics around that we're also very passionate about, because we don't believe anyone should be in a cage for a substance. So I think it's great. And the more we have the conversations, I think, even with cannabis, you'll see people have different opinions of, you know, how stuff should happen. But I think at the end of the day, just getting the conversation started and destigmatizing it is the ball game.
Yeah. I'd love to hear, you kind of briefly touched on it earlier, Emily, but you had mentioned the journaling system as a part of the sex, drugs, and rhythm, the SDR journaling system. What is that all about? And like, what's the point to this journaling system?
So the journaling system came out of all of the research that we were doing into sex, and we were trying to get our arms around how can we quantify the different aspects of sex. And one of the things that's so challenging about studying sex on psychedelics is that the things that motivate people to mix psychedelics and cannabis with sexual activity it changes the nature of the experience, and it allows sexual experiences to take on new characteristics. So the tools that have been invented to study sober sex really don't do a great job at studying things like the, you know, with a lot of people report things like a profound sense of connection. And you people studying sober sex never look at those types of things. So the what we wanted to do was create a system for studying sex with psychedelics and cannabis. And what we found is that because of what's known in the industry as set and setting, which is the idea that how you experience a psychedelic substance is going to be majorly determined by your headspace, like what your mood is, what your intentions are, and your environment. Because of those factors, a laboratory just doesn't work for studying this. That it's a little bit like needing to go study animals in the wild rather than putting them in a cage. Like the only way this works to pursue this type of science is to find ways to learn from people's sexual experiences that happen in the wild, in their own environments. And so a journaling system is very well suited for that. And what we found is that we started working with all of these biometric sensors, like there's smart vibrators, and we have a wireless EEG system, and even just like Fitbits, like regular smartwatches, can provide really helpful data for understanding what made certain orgasms more intense than others, and the different factors that go into really gaming out why it is that certain sexual experiences are so much better than others. And the SDR journaling system was what was developed as a methodology for zeroing in on the different strengths and weaknesses of different substances.
Cool. One thing that I'm kind of curious about is so in terms of my own like personal experience, sex, including psychedelics. So, you know, sex while under the influence of MDMA or LSD or even psilocybin, it can be amazing, like otherworldly, cosmically, just like mind-blowingly good. And I remember like a number of years ago, Vice put out this article, and it was about like, you know, it was about like whether or not fucking on MDMA would ruin sex for the rest of your life, kind of thing. You know what I mean? And they're like, there's that like notion of like, oh well, you can't have sex on LSD because
it's too Machiavellian.
It's too good. You know, like it'll ruin sex. What do you have to say to people who might like have that concern or might think that?
I think that's why it's so important to start with the idea that this is a natural part of our diet. Like the experience, those next level, like earth shattering experiences of sex on psychedelics, that's what we evolved to have. That's the sex you're supposed to be having. It's this prohibition induced dietary deficiency that's lowered the bar to so far that you think that even experiencing sex like that would ruin all other sex.
Yeah.
So I'd start there. But what I would add to that is that it's not as though you need to always be high in MDMA to have those experiences. What's so incredible about the way that these substances work is that they create new pathways that they can improve your sex in general, not just when you're on MDMA, but they allow you to experience new things and create pathways that so you can re-experience those experiences later free of substances.
Yeah. I'm glad you made that point, because that's I think that's one of the biggest takeaways for me in my experience with utilizing psychedelics for my own like healing and my own betterment, is that oftentimes in those experiences, while you are, you know, tripping, you're having these whether they're thoughts or feelings or epiphanies or, you know, just like your overall existence is in this bubble that is, you know, if the set and setting is the way that it should have been for you in that moment, it's allowing you to see the world through this new lens, through this new, you know, this new worldview. And it's with the correct, like, you know, integration after that experience, it's not like that worldview just goes away the next day. You're able to tap into that feeling, and the same, I've never thought about this, but until you just said it, that's the same goes for the, you know, the experience of sex on MDMA. It's fireworks going off and it's crazy and you're so present and like, oh my God, it feels so good. And this is like, I've never been so close to someone in my life. Well, to be able to recreate that without the use of substances like MDMA or LSD it's right there at your fingertips. You're, you know, that experience is there for you to have again and again and again and again, because you just had the experience. And yes, the, you know, you had the experience while on LSD, but it was the LSD that sort of taught you that you can go to that place, and that place is accessible outside of tripping, for sure. I love that. That's great.
Yeah, you take that experience with you, and it's kind of similar to other aspects around psychedelics that they're finding, you know, with anecdotal research around, you know, things like PTSD, that it helps you kind of break down those barriers, and you take that with you, you know, on your journey, you know, forward, not at that experience, but yeah, the similar kind of things.
Well, it's almost I don't really have a ton to, like, I'm learning so much just by listening to this. I don't have that much experience with the psychedelics part, but I feel like I'm just kind of hanging on here on the edge of my seat a little bit with where you're headed to. But I love neuroscience, and I just love that idea of, like, if psychedelics they open up that pathway, or they create that pathway, or allow you to create the pathway. I think the real magic about that is, like, it's in you. It's all already, you already possess that potential for that kind of connection. And I remember, you know, coming down from MDMA or having those experiences of, like, really deeply connecting with someone on an emotional level, but that, it doesn't have that same effect on the come down like alcohol does, where the next day maybe I feel like a little guilty, a little ashamed, a little embarrassed about how much of whatever I shared. But with MDMA, it's almost like, yeah, I'm glad we had that conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm glad we had that connection. And that feeling of closeness stays, even though the effects of the psychedelics are gone.
Yeah. And it's not just that. Again, like the example that I love to use is taking, there was this gentleman named Thomas Hartle. He was from out west, and he was the first Canadian patient given access to psilocybin as a patient who was dying with terminal cancer, and he had end-of-life anxieties. Thomas Hartle had never used a psychedelic in his life. He wasn't a user of cannabis. He was like, you know, he might have like a drink here or there. And so he ends up taking 7 grams of psilocybin under the guidance of a therapist. And he has this experience. And when he comes out of that experience, knowing that he had, you know, a number of months left to live, for weeks and weeks after, you know, when we spoke to him, it was weeks, you know, the trip was weeks ago. He still carried that feeling of, like, I'm okay. I don't have anything to fear. And all of my anxieties about my life coming to an end have dissipated. And that was in him. He doesn't need to be on the psilocybin. The psilocybin doesn't need to be coursing through his veins for him to have that thought, to have that experience, to have that worldview. He just needed to have that experience so that those neural pathways could be reformed, repaved, redrawn. And now that's how he goes about his life. And the same goes when we're talking about this with, like, sexuality, or, you know, an experience that makes you, I mean, for me, it's like an experience of like a closeness, like sex on psychedelics. It's like, you know, that feeling when you're with your partner and you're like, I want to squeeze you so hard that I want my atoms to mesh with your atom. Like, I want our atoms to blend together, but I can't. It's not possible.
Well, one of the things that's so much fun about doing the science, and especially when you start playing with the different, like, neuroimaging equipment, is that sensation, like that feeling, like this profound sense of connection, is that's real. Like,
yeah.
what we've learned about it's rhythmic entrainment. It's the process of having sex with somebody. It's a little bit like sharing a musical experience with someone. But when you get on the same rhythm, your brain starts syncing up, and it creates these positive feedback loops that escalate and create this enhanced sensory absorption and trance that can eventually lead to climax. But it's not like people describe it as this, like, ethereal thing, but it's physically happening to you. That that connection is a very real phenomenon that's occurring.
And it's one of those experiences too, that that, you know, I've had a handful of times in my life, and the thing that I love reflecting on so much in having those experiences is the sort of like emotional reaction or the emotional like outburst that comes from that, you know, like the feeling of having that kind of connection, that close, like, oh my God, like we are literally binding our, you know, our atoms are now meshing together, and we've had this crazy, beautifully cosmic experience, and then the sex is over, and then I'm just laying there like laughing and laughing, like, and you know, like the question is always like, what are you laughing at? And it's like, I don't know. I'm just laughing. I'm, it's just this automatic physiological response to what just occurred. Like I'm so
laughing is one of the things that we chart in the journaling system. And there's some fascinating science around it. We don't often associate laughing with sex. Like those are right. separate things. And usually they don't happen back to back unless you're on psychedelics. But if you actually study what turns people on, like very often people make a sense of humor as one of the highest, most important things in choosing a sexual partner.
Yeah.
When they've studied rated people's sense of humor and discovered that you're more likely to have other people initiate sex with you if you have a higher sense of humor, and there's a higher likelihood of bringing your partner to climax the better your sense of humor is. So sense of humor and sex are very closely connected, and part of the explanation for that we think might be comedic timing, that in the same way that like rhythmic timing makes people better at sex, it makes people better at music and dance.
Oh yeah.
Comedic timing might be part of why it is that, and yeah,
it's all connected.
That's fuck. I love that. That's so cool. That's so great. Hey, that's, I mean, hey, everybody wonders why Pete Davidson does so well with, you know, he's a funny fucking dude.
Yeah.
You know? I love that though. The comedic timing, kind of tying that in with like the, you know, the rhythm
it's
of
a
like
rhythm.
A good dancer.
It's a rhythm. Yeah,
totally. That's awesome. I love that.
Yeah.
That explains so much, like, Bridie.
When you start like looking at it too, like when we were developing the theory and just, you know, discovering all of it, like you'll just be watching stuff. So, you know, the sex, drugs, and rhythm will just pop up. Like you're like, okay, here's a documentary on, you know, Woodstock. You're like, oh, sex, drugs, and rhythm. You know, oh, here's a scene from a movie at a rave, and oh, everyone is, you know, taking MDMA and showing them all together and connectedness, but like moving in this rhythm. And it's really just this like very eye-opening, huh? Okay, well, we all are on this plane and everything is very connected, you know. It gets very, very meta very quickly.
Very cool.
The book is called Transforming Orgasms with Psychedelics, Cannabis, and Science, as opposed to Transforming Sex. And I'm wondering if there an orgasm specific component. Is there something about the moments of orgasms specifically that you two were focusing on with this?
It's a great question. So the focus of our research has really been about rhythm and rhythmic entrainment. And that led to a study of sex, but it actually, we were originally studying epilepsy and like CBD treating seizure activity. And then there was a major discovery that came out that showed that the biomechanics behind seizure activity is actually, there's parallels between that and the biomechanics of orgasms, and it's rhythmic entrainment. It's this idea that rhythm, you experience rhythm, and it enhances the sensory absorption in trance. And as you pass these critical threshold points, your level of sensory absorption increases, and it can eventually culminate in a climax. And that, so there's that rhythmic event that takes place. And then the climax itself, a lot of people, you know, you experience an orgasm in a deep state of trance. So the memory of an orgasm is always kind of fragmented. Usually you get these little snapshot images. But what a lot of people don't realize is on a physiological level, there's actually a rhythmic event happening, that it's a series of rhythmic contractions on the pelvic floor. And different people have distinctive orgasm patterns. And most people fall into one of three orgasm patterns. There's some outliers, but most people fit pretty neatly into one of three different types of orgasm patterns. And those patterns can still have a pretty wide envelope. Like, they, you know, an orgasm might be longer or shorter or more intense or less intense, but there's still a discernible rhythmic factor to it. And that's really been the focus of our research, is the way that cannabinoids and psychedelics impacts that the rhythmic events surrounding climax.
I'm just fascinated by that. I have lots of Googling to do, I think.
Do you guys individually have like a certain psychedelic or perhaps a certain like THC and other cannabinoid combination that you like, that you really enjoy the most when combining with sex?
We're pretty eclectic. without saying anything too illegal, but we have a pretty diverse appetite. I'll say our focus research wise is on cannabis and peyote. Peyote is legal in Canada and it's very understudied, and my main research is in cultivating different rare cultivars of peyote and studying the different lesser known chemicals found within them. Emily's main, like, her day job is all cannabis, so her main focus is on rare cannabinoids. But we both have very scientific approaches to these whole things, and one of the fun things about publishing this book is we've had a bunch of people reach out to us who are developing different next generation psychedelics for sexual applications, and we're interested in that too. We want to, you know, the industry is going in some very interesting directions, and we want to be able to do a good job of testing the different substances and seeing their strengths and weaknesses on the merits.
Mm. I would say too, edibles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just, I consume, you know, I vape a lot, and mostly for medical, and it's, I have ADHD and dyslexia, and I found very early on that it calms me down. So like most people, you know, are trying to not have that reaction. It actually helps, just me become, you know, kind of homeostasis. Mm. Whereas when I, you know, edibles are a little bit more of that body kind of feeling. So, you know, it makes really good chocolate pudding that we've been putting edibles in. So that's just me personally. I like to, like Nate said, we've been in the space a long time, so we're not picky, but I would just go with edibles personally. Gummies, you know.
Yeah.
What do you think about, this is a slight departure, but what do you think about like topical sexual lubricants and stuff like that?
Some of them are next level awesome. Like the cannabis infused lubricants, there are some just incredible products out there, and there's we've cited some reports of people using them in conjunction with biometric sensors and showing definitively that it made their orgasm 5 times longer and 3 times more intense. Like,
oh, wow.
There's really solid data that it does very real things to sexual experiences.
Yeah, cool. There's a lot of data on blood flow. So like when you're applying it topically, it's reacting with different receptors in there. When you get into, you know, the vulva and anus regions, there's a little bit different because it's an open skin, you know, whereas if you were to apply it topically, it's not going to cross that blood-brain barrier, like, you know, on just your regular skin. So there's some fascinating data around that people are looking into. It's I think it's a big topic coming out in the industry right now, just sexual health and kind of these hidden secrets around it.
Because some of the chemicals that are found naturally in cannabis are like they're chemically nearly identical to are the chemicals that our body uses for the sexual reward systems. Hmm. Like the human endocannabinoid system is responsible for creating the chemical signals that cause you to experience pleasure. So, you know, adding some of those or supplementing some of those with the plant medicine, it makes sense that it would have those effects. It's like logically you would expect it to have that effect.
And it's kind of a dual prong too. So if you're with your partner and you're using, you know, something topically and then you're ingesting that could be something, versus there's the other aspect of people using it, you know, on themselves, you know, in those areas. And it's another, so there's like topical and also ingestion. Like there's a lot at play with those products.
This is this whole episode has just been like,
I know, you're so excited.
I know,
so much fun, right?
So fun. I'm so excited about the book, guys. Transforming Orgasms with Psychedelics, Cannabis, and Science. It's available now, correct?
Correct.
On Amazon.
Amazon, it's there. Get it. Read it. Dive in. This is such cool stuff. I'm big fans of what you guys are up to, and I can't wait to sink my teeth into the book.
Awesome. Yeah, it's very graphic friendly. We didn't want to have, like I said, we're both dyslexic and ADHD, so we wanted to make it a lot of information, but accessible to people, and not, you know, a lot of graphics, a lot of explanations, a lot of incitations. So.
And it's it's beautiful. Like I was kind of perusing through it here while we were speaking. The art design, it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous book. So congratulations. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to sit down and chat with us today. This has been so great. How can people find
transformingorgasms.com?
Amazing.
Reach out to us. We love hearing from people. If you have any experiences to share, certainly if you try using the journal, but even if you just have your own experiences to share, we love hearing from people.
And the journaling, like, are there prompts and stuff like that in the book? That's what's going
there
on.
There is.
Yeah. They're all, it's color coded. If anyone knows me, I am big on color coding. So if you look at the, even together, it's like this nice, beautiful ombre. That's all color coded and with different questions. And yeah, you can use it by yourself, you know, even for me, like just mentally knowing those questions has been helpful. Not necessarily like writing them down, but we also have on our website the Google Form version of it. So if you did want to like fill it out, you can do that as well.
Cool. Amazing.
That's so
great. Again, that's transformingorgasms.com. And the book Transforming Orgasms with Psychedelics, Cannabis, and Science, available now on Amazon. Guys, thank you so much. This has been such a treat. Thank you.
Our
pleasure.
So
thank you.
All right, there we have it, folks. Hope you enjoyed that conversation that we just had. And thanks for listening to the podcast. If you want to support the podcast further, you can do that by leaving a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, or you can simply rate the podcast on the Spotify mobile app. And if you want to support the podcast even further than that, which you can.
Wow.
You can go to
so kind and thoughtful and
so
generous.
Thoughtful, so generous. Go to patreon.com/turnmeon. To become a patron and help us keep this podcast afloat.
Well, if you want to reach out to us, turnmeonpodcast@gmail.com is always open for all of your messages. That's the best way to get in touch. If you have a question for us, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, if you have a recommendation for a guest on the show, or if you just want to send us a little love note, email, money transfer, all of that.
Sex toy.
You know, our email inbox is open to you.
That is it for this week. Until next week.
Why don't you go touch yourself?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.